Second case today is appeal number 2014-1822 and 1823. This is Convatec Technologies Incorporated versus Smith & Nephew Incorporated. Mr. Torkson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to address two issues in this case. One is the claim construction issue and then the amendment practice. In Microsoft versus Proxicon, this Court reaffirmed that the broadest reasonable interpretation standard requires taking the specification into account. Convatec was prejudiced in this case precisely because the Board failed to do so. We're contesting two limitations. The incorporating silver limitation, Convatec pointed out that that required loading. Smith argued, and the Board accepted, that incorporation is a generic concept and loading is just the species. The Board erred there. There is no substantial evidence in the
study. If you meant loading, why didn't you use the word loading in the claims?
The claims, well, the specification uses it as a synonym, so it didn't matter which word was used.
Well, that sounds kind of contrary to our normal practice of not reading specific embodiments of the specification into broader claim language.
I agree, Your Honor, and that is not at all what Convatec is asking the Court to do. The reason I'm saying that there's no substantial evidence in the specification is because it's literally true. There's no substantial evidence for broader reading. In fact, the grammar of the specification requires you to read loading and incorporating as synonyms.
Loading means some kind of ionic exchange between the silver and the polymer, right?
Precisely, Your Honor. And that's
can an unmodified polysaccharide have that kind of ionic exchange with the silver?
Nobody is saying that it would, but if you read the
But then the claim language actually talks about, includes a polysaccharide having this silver incorporated in it.
It does, Your Honor, but it does.
So then why would we be compelled to read incorporate to mean something that can't fit or can't be done by the recited polysaccharide in the claim?
Well, allow me two responses to that. First of all, again, because the specification uses them as synonyms, if there's a problem, it's a different problem. If the claim is inconsistent, but in fact the claim language is not inconsistent because it gives a group of fibers that can be used individually or in mixtures, but it gives further guidance that restricts the choice within that.
But you don't think we can read the claim to, and then the rest of the structure of the specification together to try to understand what's the best understanding of what the inventor contemplated when it talked about using a polysaccharide? Unmodified polysaccharide is the polymer?
I am not asking this Court to read anything out of the claims or out of the invention. In fact, quite to the contrary, but it's well established in this Court's precedent that you have to read the claim as a whole. That if, I believe In re Cook, for instance, talks about if there are inoperative embodiments, but it would be clear what those would be from the language of the claim itself, you can't pick and in something that would be inoperative by ignoring
Cook
the other limitations.
Cook was a very broad generic claim, right? Here, your claim is specifically reciting and declaring to the world that one of the embodiments is a polymer that consists of a polysaccharide. And so it looks to me like it's different from Cook.
It's not a generic claim, it's true, but it's a group that you can choose from either individually or in combination, but any choice you make from that has to comply with the incorporation, which the specification tells you means loading, and it also has to be photocycled. So there are other limitations that guide whatever choices you would make there. An analogy might be if I told you to go that you could pick any fruit you wanted as long as it was orange. If you're looking at a table and there's bananas there, they're probably not orange. You can't choose that. You know that that's not an acceptable choice.
So I guess you're expecting us to read the claim that the inventor drafted and ignore the term polysaccharide so that we can understand the word incorporate in the claim to mean something much more specific, i.e. loading, i.e. ionic exchange.
The specification gives us no choice.
Is that fair to say, that that's the argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the specification gives you no choice. There's no grammatical sense in the specification except to reloading as incorporate. So then the question is, what do you do with the fact that there are non-ionic fibers listed in the claim? Well, the answer is you can use those in combination with the ionic fibers, or at least in some of the claims, those fibers, there's nothing that restricts them from being modified. So in either
situation, it says consisting of, though. I mean, what does consisting of mean when it says consisting of polysaccharide? But doesn't that contemplate that it is polysaccharide, period, as the fiber, the polymer?
You wouldn't choose just polysaccharide alone, because read in context with the rest of the claim, that would be an illegitimate choice. But the consisting of polysaccharide with a mixture of other fibers, it's very easy to come up with compliant examples. I'm going to run short of time, though, if I can't move on to the other one.
Okay.
Okay, the other limitation we are contesting is the substantially photostable when dry. Again, if you read the specification, it's clear what's going on. The specification tells us that the use of silver in these materials is old, that a known problem with that is uncontrolled discoloration. In the very next sentence, it explains that the solution is to make a photostable material. So the solution to uncontrolled discoloration is photostable material. It explains the prior solutions trying to do that in the prior art were unsatisfactory. The specification then goes on to define photostable as allowing controlled color change to a desired color and then minimal change thereafter. It's important to read that minimal change in light of how photostable has been described earlier, which is that it is a solution to discoloration. So whatever minimal color change thereafter means, it can't mean discoloration. Smith argued, and the board held, however, that
the language here is it's a little confusing to me, maybe even a little tricky. I don't know what it means when it says controlled color change to a desired color. To me, just that opening phrase suggests you start with a color A, and now you change in some controlled way to a color B, where color B is a desired color.
Right, but that makes perfect sense in the context.
So the color starts off as what? White?
In the examples in the prior art that I'd like to get to, yes, that's exactly what happens.
And then, so now it's got to change to a desired color to be photostable. What would that desired color be?
It doesn't matter, Your Honor. Any color, as long as it's not this color.
Okay, but
because the point of this.
Would purple be?
Purple would be absolutely fine. The point.
So it can change from. You're telling me you can change from white to purple, because that would be a controlled color change to a desired color.
That's the key phrase, Your Honor. It has to be a controlled change to that desired color, and once you get that desired color, it can't be something else. And again, this is why this is so prejudicial, because. Once you accept that the claim requires ionic bonding, all the other references except Gibbons aren't a problem. Gibbons, because of the construction that Smith argued and the board adopted, it looked at Gibbons, which gives example 25, which gives 15 samples. Two of them are controls. They stay white. Every other example turns purplish and when dry, and Gibbons itself describes that as discolored. That's why Judge Snedden below dissented. He says there's no way that could possibly be the right construction. Judge Snedden, unfortunately,
the board went on and said that purplish could fit within the understanding of a claim construction for photostable, right?
Not if it results in discoloration.
I mean, I think
because that's the whole point.
First of all, the board construed substantially photostable to mean, this is A40, that the material may undergo a controlled color change to a desired color with some minimal discoloration, even to an undesirable color from the desired color, and even some degree beyond a minimal discoloration and still be considered substantially photostable. and then goes on to say, even if purple were shown to be an undesirable color, given 751 reports a change to purplish or having purple specks, such a description indicates only a substantially minimal color change to purple that is encompassed by the broad language recited in the claims and the broad definition for photostable.
Again, it's ignoring the fact that photostable is first mentioned in the spec in the context of being the cure. Every art recognized cure for discoloration. So if the board adopts a definition of color, photostable that permits discoloration, that's unreasonable.
Why? But it says minimal change thereafter.
Right.
I mean, that why doesn't that encompass minimal discoloration thereafter?
Discoloration it can't include. A color change to something would be okay, but again, the context of this is medical devices. You pull a medical device out of the package and it has specks on it, or stains or blotches, that's going to be interpreted by the end user, the clinician, or worse yet, the patient, as a sign of defect or contamination or tampering. So the whole point of this invention is to avoid discoloration, and in fact, that's the problem with Judge Sneddon's concurrence. Not only does he create a new ground of rejection, but in doing so, he says no apparent discoloration, but in fact, if you look at the examples that are cited, the control remains white. One of the samples turns purple, and the other one is purple and has specks. The problem with that is not that it's purple, the problem is that it has specks. He says specks are a minimal problem, but in this context, specks are exactly what you want to avoid, because that's precisely the discoloration that's going to suggest to the end
user. So then what does minimal change thereafter mean to you? It says change to a desired color, and then minimal change thereafter. What is it a minimal change to yet a different desired color?
Yeah, like that could be fine.
All it can encompass? It can't encompass minimal undesired change?
It can't discolor. It cannot discolor. That is the thing that it can't do. It cannot discolor to the point that one skill that an end user would recognize that as a problem, or at least assume that it's going to be a problem.
And here the board seemed to find that a purplish tinge fits within the claim language.
Two of the judges even did that because it really is unreasonable in light of the specification. I'm into my rebuttal time. I would like to briefly touch on the fact that, yes, we understand that the court decided Cuozzo. Yes, we understand that the court said that Chevron deference applies to the board's administration of these proceedings. We've never contested that proposition. We do question whether Chevron's been appropriately or whether it's been followed appropriately here. There's a three-part test to Chevron. One is, are they administering the system? Are they filling a gap, and have they done so reasonably? We believe that there are problems on all aspects of that. Specifically, unlike in Chevron, where the EPA went through an extensive record building to develop an independent standard, the board didn't do that.
I'm sorry, which rule are we talking about? Which rule are you targeting right now?
Well, okay, there are two, but I'm talking initially about adoption of the broadest reasonable interpretation, and then we'll also talk about the gap.
But, I mean, Cuozzo resolves the broadest reasonable interpretation issue.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have to argue if you want us to review that.
Your Honor, you're missing the point. We embrace the broadest reasonable interpretation.
Oh, you're just saying they have applied it incorrectly.
They have applied it seriously incorrectly here because it's not their standard. They didn't do the work to make the standard. They simply adopted this court's standard. So in how you interpret that standard, they are entitled to no deference. Rather, the question is how faithful are they to that standard? So if the board said, in addition, that what was reasonable was judged from the perspective of an APJ at the time of the decision, this court would have no problem saying, no, that's wrong. It's the perspective of one ordinary skill in the art at the time of filing. Similarly, this case, the court's case law makes it very clear that there's got to be a fair chance to amend the claims. In Cuozzo, it said that the court didn't see a difference, but on the facts in Cuozzo, that was a broadening amendment. So there was no difference from post-grant practice elsewhere. On the facts of this case, there is a problem because it's a narrowing amendment. The board has adopted to our prejudice on the facts of this case, the requirement that we prove patentability. That's flatly contradictory to 316E. There is no gap to fill there.
Didn't we say in ProxyCon that the burden's on the patent owner?
Yes, but ProxyCon doesn't address the plain language of 316E, Your Honor. The board can't fill a gap where no gap exists. Congress filled that gap. The board has no discretion to fill it.
Okay, I see you're way into your point. All right, let's hear from the other side. All right, the time is being split. Mr. Lenny, you're taking 10 minutes, and then Ms. Lateef is taking 5.
That's correct.
Right? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Brad Lenny for the Appellee Smith & Nephew. The board correctly decided all the key issues in this case, and the board's decisions in these two IPR proceedings should be affirmed in their entirety. I'd first like to key off with some of the discussion regarding Comitech's arguments with respect to the incorporation term. So, Your Honors, we're focused on the example of unmodified polysaccharides being incapable of undergoing ion exchange between the polymer and the silver. That's also true with respect to polyurethane, and that's another point that's not contested by Convitec. But in addition to the claims themselves being able to select from that class of polymers, the specification also states very clearly that the same list of polymers are suitable for the invention. So they've got to square that idea that they've described in the specification, two examples of polymers that are incapable of undergoing ion exchange as being suitable for the invention. And the idea that the specification equates the term loading and incorporation is just completely unsupported. If you look what the specification does, it specifically defines one term, loading, to require ion exchange, but the other term, incorporation, isn't disclosed at all.
Right, but then the patent also talks about loading just above the definition for loading and talks about it in the same way that the patent earlier talks about incorporating. That is to say that when you do the steps a certain way, then the silver gets incorporated or the silver loads into
right.
the polymer. So
and that's not inconsistent with some of the polymers that are described. But importantly, that loading is only going to happen where you have polymers that have ion exchange units to permit ionic bonding. Now, on photostability, I think counsel for Convitec just admitted that a change from white to purple would be acceptable. Now, that's completely contrary to their expert extrinsic evidence that said purple is an undesirable color. So I think I just heard them completely backtrack from their expert that put in a declaration that said the only acceptable colors as far as the desired color are white and whitish gray, and that purple is definitely not an acceptable color. So that's an interesting change of tact on their part factually. A couple other things on the definition of photostable. The definition allows for controlled color change to a desired color. And that clearly allows for discoloration. So while Comitec tries to describe the invention as solving a discoloration problem, they specifically defined photostable to allow for discoloration. Now that's not our problem. The fact that they coined the term photostable extremely broadly in a way that is very much at odds with the normal definition of photostable is something that they've got to live with. When they wrote these claims, if they wanted to have a material that was sensitive to light stability, they didn't have to use the word photostable because it incorporated such a broad term. They could have said that the resulting material doesn't discolor when exposed to light. That would have been a different way to claim what they're now trying to do.
But the whole context of the patent, the whole contribution to the art is to neutralize discoloration.
Well, not necessarily. So it's twofold. It deals with making it more photostable, but also antimicrobial. So there may be some tension there.
Antimicrobial was already part of the prior art. The problem was these antimicrobial agents would discolor use, and so the invention was designed to figure out a way to neutralize the discoloration.
I don't dispute that one of the problems that the patent is seeking to solve is discoloration. However, they coined the phrase photostable extremely broadly, and that's something that is a public notice function to the public at large and is entitled to rely on that definition. So I don't think you can rewrite the express definition that they've provided in the specification to allow for discoloration.
So where in the definition of photostable do you take it that it encompasses some
discoloration.
So it's in the first step where you have controlled color change to a desired color.
How could that possibly be discoloration? How could desired color be discoloration?
I agree, that wouldn't be discoloration.
Okay, so then where's the discoloration in the definition for photostable?
It's after you have that controlled color change to a desired color.
It's the minimal change thereafter?
If there's more than minimal color change thereafter, that would be discoloration. So you can go from white to purple, and then if upon further exposure to light, after you open the package, for example, it went to a further dark purple or a different color, red or blue or black, that would be further more than minimal discoloration, and then that would not be a photostable material.
Let me see if I get this straight. It could be white at first.
Yes.
It gets exposed to light somehow, and then maybe goes to some light purple.
Yes.
But then thereafter, it moves to deep purple.
Correct. That would not be photostable.
That would not be photostable.
Correct.
But if it went to light purple and stayed at light purple, that would be okay?
That's right. And again, that's just what Gibbons did. So if you look at the Gibbons example, Gibbons is working with a white wound dressing. It exposes it to the silverization process and then exposes it to light. And this is Gibbons doing the experiment. So this is akin to the manufacturer, intentionally exposing it to light, and it turns purple. If you then package it and you open up the package and it stays purple or just has minimal color change, that's a photostable material. If, on the other hand, Gibbons exposes it to light intentionally, it goes to purple, you package it, open up the package, and it turns black or it turns dark purple, it wouldn't be photostable. But the evidence on Gibbons is that the change from white to purplish or the change from white to purple specks is not appreciably discoloring in light. I mean, he said that Gibbons recognized that it was discolored, but if you look at the Gibbons reference, and this is in example 24. So there's example 24 and example 25. They both report color change from white to purplish. And in example 24, he says those samples, all these samples, did not appreciably discolor in light. So that's Gibbons, you know, expressly stating that the change from white to purple is not appreciably discolored.
Or white to purplish.
Or white to purplish.
Or
correct.
White to purple specks.
That's right. Briefly, I'd like to go on to the motion to amend. ComTech challenges the board's denial of its motion to amend, but from this court's recent decision on Microsoft v. Proxicon, the one thing that this court stated that at a minimum a patent owner needs to do to prevail on a motion to amend at an IPR proceeding is demonstrate how the amendments overcome the prior art of record. Now, the board found that there were a number of reasons that the motion to amend was deficient, but significantly, the board found that the amendments failed to overcome the Gibbons reference. And that's very clear in the record that they failed to overcome the Gibbons reference. The three amendments that were made were adding that the polymer be a gel-forming fiber, it replaced incorporate with load, which would require ionic bonding, and then it deleted substantially from the term substantially photostable. Gibbons unquestionably discloses a gel-forming fiber. That's not in dispute. As far as loading, the only argument that ComTech had as to why Gibbons didn't result in ionic bonding and loading was because it claimed example 25M was in the reverse order. It said Gibbons exposed the polymer first to the salt agent and then to silver. The board squarely disagreed with ComTech on that factual issue. That the board's decision that the example 25 is in the correct order is supported by substantial evidence, and there's no dispute that if it's in the right order,
25M, right?
25M.
Okay.
M. And finally, the board held that because Gibbons is applying a substantial identical process to the exact same Aquacell commercial product that's described in the 918 patent, that you'll necessarily inherently get a photostable material. And again, that's not something that ConvaTech challenges.
Well,
further,
I think ConvaTech seems to be challenging whether there should even be a burden placed on it in terms of being able to have its amendment motion granted,
right.
Suggesting that the Proxicon opinion didn't address some kind of statutory question under Section 316.
Yeah, my understanding is that the Proxicon decision resolved that issue and said it was entirely proper for the Patent Office to implement its statutory mandate and require to place the burden on Convitec to establish that its claims are patentable and it's entitled to its motion to amend. Real quickly, in addition to that, there's an additional prior art combination that they don't overcome with their amendments, and that's a combination of Creedle and Bahia. And that combination, we explained in our opposition to the motion to amend, that it results in total stability. That's unquestioned. The only challenge to that combination by Convitec in its reply brief on the motion to amend was that you wouldn't properly combine it and there wasn't a sufficient motivation to combine the two references. Again, on that point, the board agreed with us. The board agreed with Smith and Nephew that there was sufficient evidence to have a motivation to combine the Creedle and Bahia references, and they did that in connection with some of the dependent original claims, and that motivational finding is at A26, and for the reason that we stated in the brief, that combination also renders each of the amended claims unpatentable and is sufficient to defeat the board.
You're out of time. I'm sorry, Mr. Lenny. Can we move on to Ms. Lateef?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Monica Lateef on behalf of the United States Patent and Trademark Office, and I'm here to talk about the one procedural aspect of the Board's decision, which is the motion to amend. I agree with Smith and Nephew's counsel that this case falls squarely within the Microsoft v. Proxicon decision, and to the extent that there is a question about the burden in proving the motion to amend, I think that that precedential case answered that question.
Did that case address Section 316 of the Patent Act, which seems to suggest that the burden's on the petitioner?
Well, the case talks about the fact that because it's the patent owner who's moving for the motion, that the burden falls on the movement. However, to the extent there's concern about Section 316, that section is talking about an issued patent and claims within an issued patent, looking at, as it says, proving a proposition of unpatentability. In a motion to amend, you have proposed claims. You're not looking at a proposition of unpatentability. What you're trying to do is basically prove that you can have these claims in a patent. So it's the statute that would be applicable to the proposed amended claims would be 3116A9, where you're basically saying that the director can prescribe regulations setting forth the standards and procedures. So 316E isn't really applicable to proposed amended claims. They're not actual claims. So as far as work, it's under the office's position is basically that this case is just like Microsoft v. Proxicon. Here, Convitec failed to demonstrate that its claims are patentable over the prior art of record, which was Gibbons, and Gibbons was a part of the IPR from the very beginning. Beyond that, any other explanations that the court made about the motion to amend were just alternative reasons why it was deficient. The court doesn't have to reach those, but to the extent the court has questions about those, I'm happy to answer them.
Yeah, the board seems to have a practice in terms of motions to amend. It has a rule that patent owners have to show written description support in the original filed patent application and can't just rely on the actual patent that was granted. And here, the patent owner relied on the patent granted, which is identical to the original filing. Doesn't it seem kind of ticky-tack to reject the amendment for that hyper-technical reason?
Respectfully, I would disagree, Your Honor. It's part of our regulations. While the
it's in the regulation?
I'm sorry?
This rule is in the regulation that you have to go all the way back to the actual specification you filed with PTO?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in 37 CFR 42.121, where it says that a motion to amend must include a claim listing showing the claims changes clearly and set forth the support in the original disclosure of the patent for each claim that is added or amended. So it's required that you show it in the original disclosure. Whether or not the original disclosure and the issued patent have the same specification, we have no way of knowing that. The Calvin-Tech didn't say that they did. You know, they just pointed to the patent, and our rules require that you point to the original disclosure. So we are basically holding them to our rules. I don't think that's a sort of a technical error on their part.
Can you explain what did this recent board order called Master Image do with respect to idle-free and this practice of what are the demands and expectations on patent owners when it comes to motions to amend?
Sure, I'm happy to do that, Your Honor. I just want to reiterate that this case, I think you don't necessarily need to turn on that section, but I'm happy to answer the question, which is basically under our regulations.
Well, let's ask it differently then. Are you saying that now that the board has apparently adjusted its practice, we shouldn't consider this particular ground for rejecting the amendments here?
No, and I apologize if that's sort of how you interpreted my answer. What I'm saying is, in this particular case, Convatec failed to meet the bare minimum, which is demonstrating patentability over the prior art of record. So in this particular case, you can decide on that alone. But to answer your question about this, the board requiring that people, that patent owners demonstrate patentability over prior art of record and prior art known to the patent owner, I'm happy to answer that, and I will. I just wanted to make it clear that that's not dispositive here. But to answer you, so under our regulations, we require that patent owners prove patentability over the prior art of record as well as prior art known to the patent owner. There's a duty of disclosure in our regulations, which is 37 CFR 42.11, and all we're asking is that in addition to the prior art of record, you also let us know what is known to you, and we use Idle Free and Master Image 3D to basically explain what we mean by that. It's always been in our regulations. It's not changing the regulations. It's just helping the public sort of understand what it is we're looking for. And if you look at Master Image, it sort of breaks down what they mean by prior art of record, and it talks about any prior art in the material in the prosecution history as well as in the IPR proceeding.
Right, no, the more interesting part is the prior art that is not in the record somehow, but is somehow known to the patent owner.
Sure, well, if you have a duty of disclosure, you should always be submitting any prior art known to you.
Are you saying that it's the PTO's position that there's no daylight between what the Master Image order says and what the Idle Free order says?
When you say daylight, you mean, am I suggesting...
Was there any kind of adjustment? Was there a change in practice?
It's not a change in practice as much as it's an explanation of... There was obviously confusion among the public. You know, people weren't sure what Idle Free was saying. So
yeah, that's because this board decision seemed to say that this patent owner needed to come forward and explain all the prior art it knew and why that prior art that it knew did not render this amended claim unpatentable.
Right,
and now the Master Image order seems to be not requiring that.
Well, I disagree. I think the Master Image order explains that you still always have your duty of candor. So basically it's laying out what prior art of record means, just making it clear, and then it's saying, but keep in mind, your duty of candor always remains. 37 CFR 42.11 has always been there. You're always required, to the extent you find something, to supplement the record with it, or when you're doing your motion to amend, you can share it then. But it hasn't changed anything. Nothing. It's always been there. It's always been a requirement.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. McCabe. Let's, Mr. Twerkson, we'll give you 2 minutes. 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay, a lot to discuss, then, Your Honor. I'd like to start off by talking about the who has the burden on patentability. The statute is very clear. It doesn't say original claims. It doesn't say except when there's an amendment. But what I thought was really telling about my friend's argument is she says proposed claims don't have a burden of patentability. Well, but then she tells us that the rules themselves impose a burden of patentability. Either the patent owner is facing a burden of patentability or it's not. The board said we were and we failed to carry it. We're pointing out that the statute doesn't allow the board to do that. If at the end of the analysis, when it's looked at the opposition and everything else, it decides the claims are unpatentable, that's fine.
Right.
That's
I guess maybe their point of view is the claim is not really a claim yet, in the same way that the term claim is used in Section 316, which is referring to issued patent claims, and now these are, you know, stand-in proposed claims.
Two mistakes with that line of reasoning, Your Honor. First of all, the statute doesn't make that distinction. It says, in an inter-parties review, a petitioner has the burden of proving a proposition of the unpatentability. So any proposition
of unpatentability... Is it the patent board's responsibility then to go do a prior art search once someone files an amendment?
The board certainly has the discretion to do it. And in fact, they didn't make this argument.
I'm just trying to understand, as a practical matter, how does it work?
As a practical matter, there are
you can write, you can amend the claim. Now the claim is a different claim.
Right.
And the board, if it doesn't do an examination, then the claim could just go out the door unexamined?
Well, one, that doesn't happen because the board, in fact, does examine. There are at least two instances of examination. In this case, in Cuozzo, the board entered a new ground of rejection. The court, at the solicitor's suggestion, accepted that the board can do examination. So it does have the discretion to do examination. Whether it should in every case, of course, it's up to the board's discretion. But Congress recognized this problem. So there are two guarantors. One is the claims can only be narrower. So even if they issue still unpatentable over some unknown prior art, they're less unpatentable than they were before. So the public is better off. Remember when the PTO says we have to consider efficiency in making our rules, they also are supposed to consider the effect on the economy and the integrity of the patent system. An amendment process makes the claims better. They may not be perfect, but they're better than they were. That promotes the economy. That promotes the integrity.
I'm sorry, you're over your time. Do you have a last point, a final point?
Congress itself allows the board to consider the claim amendments even if the petitioner settles out of the case, and they did that in the International Fragrances case without opposition. So clearly the board can examine if it wants to or not examine if it wants to. Congress knew what it was doing.
Okay, thank you. The case is submitted.